52.
Okay.
So beware, okay?
Out on the floor. You know, in 1956, this meditation, for some reason, recalled to my mind the time in 1956 when Baba gathered all of us that were there. It must have been 200 around him at the center, and he wore a long white sadra that day, and he looked so much like Christ at the time. It was fantastic. He stood there, and the sun was streaming down on him, and he said, "I want you all to look into my eyes." And he stood there, and we stood in a huge circle around him, and we all looked into his eyes, and it must have lasted for 5 or 10 minutes. He never explained this. I don't know what it was all about, but it seemed at the time that there was a dead silence. Even the birds, the rustling of the leaves, I must have been within me, but there was this deep silence. Well, everybody just looked into his eyes. And I do think that looking at his photographs, you know, when you're meditating, helps a lot, especially for beginners. If you can only do it for a minute a day, it's a big help. How many new people are here today? One? Two? Three? Yeah. Well, last time I spoke, I had to split it up into two sessions, and it was much too long. And this time I thought, well, I brought my notes with me, not so much to remind me what to say, but to remind me what not to say, to see if we could cut it down a little bit. I believe it was 3.5 hours altogether, and that's really too much. I have to leave out big gobs of everything. So, is there anything special you want to know before I begin? Any particular part?
Tell the beginning part.
The beginning part, how I met Baba?
Yeah, the first meeting.
Well, I think I can leave a lot of that out, you know. You know, because it's really so long and so involved. And again, I think I better drag my notes out just to keep from saying too much. What I'll try to bring out is what I brought out once before. I tried to bring it out. But I say much more than what's in here, too. But you know, with Baba, there's no end to the things you can say. Well, to begin with, I was an atheist. Or I thought I was, which is about the same thing anyway. And I left the church, which was Church of England, Episcopal Church, when I was about 13. I was confirmed, and I said, no more. And that was the last time. I fought with my family about it, and I just couldn't see it. I felt there was a lot of hypocrisy, and I had the same problems with the establishment that all the young people have today. It was exactly the same thing, only there were fewer of us, I think. And that was the end of that, as far as the church was concerned. Well, there are, when Baba is bringing you to him, he uses scaffolding. You've probably heard this expression before. He builds up a scaffolding. When he does the work that he wants through the scaffolding, it's torn down. There are key people, too, in your life, to which he draws you to him. I'll try, if I can, to trace these things for you to show you how Baba works. Because the real miracle of Baba is not so much in his performing a miracle, you know, that thing, wow, look at that, he raised someone from the dead, or he turned water into wine. No, Baba acted like everybody else, and he worked in such a very subtle way, and just normal things were happening. And then it wasn't until about 10 years later you realize, wow, what happened here? You know, his whole life was a miracle. Everything he did was a miracle. Well, to make a long story short, I was at Arthur Murray's. I was teaching there. I was brought there in a sense by my brother-in-law, who had been a teacher there. And he was a key person in my life. Of course, he brought me to Arthur Murray's. And when I was at Arthur Murray's, I met my future husband, who became a pupil of mine and who became a teacher also. Then there was a big strike. So we were all, we joined the strikers, and we went out and picketed and everything. And of course, for me, I was an executive there at the time, and you know, to be on strike, and well, you just couldn't ever hope to go back, and I knew I never would. But my husband was out on strike with me, and it was a great big mess, and of course, that was the end of that scaffolding for us, anyway. But during the strike, we were looking for a place to teach our pupils, and my ex-husband found this place called the Maya Bolin Studios. Maya Bolin, you get that name? And we took our pupils there that had left the strike, left the Arthur Murray's with us to support us. And they never went back either, so they stayed with us, and we taught them at the Maya Bolin Studios and paid rent. Well, for the teachers, the pupils there. Well, that was a little studio, and it was really on the rocks. We didn't know it at the time, but they certainly welcomed us with our rental for the pupils. So while we were there, I was asked if I would become manager of the studio. And meantime, I had been asked if I would become the manager of the Slenderizing Salon. So I couldn't make up my mind, you know. And the people there who owned the studio knew that I was, you know, they knew that I was atheistic. I knew there was something peculiar about me, that they adhered to some kind of belief, but they never spoke to me about it because they knew how very much against it I was. You know, I just would have nothing unless it was science or something like that. So it's getting hot here. I didn't know what to do, which of these two jobs I should take. And one day, one of the teachers from the studio, she was a Catholic, incidentally, and a very devout Catholic, I had lunch with her, and she said, "Why don't you come and be manager? We'd like to have you. We knew you at Murray's, and, you know, we think that we'd like to have you." I said, "Well, I don't know. I have another job offer, and I don't know. I really don't know what I want to do." And she said, "Why don't you pray?" I said, "Pray?" I wouldn't pray. I said, "I don't believe in that sort of thing." And she said, "Well, Billy," she said, "supposing you didn't have your health anymore, and you didn't have your family, and you didn't have your husband, and you didn't have a job, and you had nothing at all, what would you do?" Oh, I said, "Oh, I guess I'd do like anybody else, but sort of, you know, his home." I thought, "But what'd I do?" You see, up to this time, I had had a very sheltered gay life. All the boyfriends I wanted, because in those days, the boys were different than what they are now. They'd bring you flowers, and, you know, they'd get all dressed up, and they'd take it taxi. You know, it was not so casual as it is today. They made a big fuss of you for some reason or other. So, you know, I just thought, you know, that was life. Life was just to have a good time. You know, it was amazing how naive I was. So I said, "Well, maybe it would be kind of awful to have all these things happening." So then the manager of the studio came to me and asked the same question. Would I, you know, become manager of the studio? I said, "Well, I don't know what to do." He said, "Well," I said, "what do they offer?" And he told me base salary that they offered. So I thought, "Well, I tell you what I'll do." I said, "If you'll give me so much," which I asked for more, "plus a percentage of the gross, I'll come." I never thought in a million years they'd do it, you see. So that night I went home and I thought, to do something. And you know, there's a lesson in this. I honestly believe, and it's happened all my life, if you turn to God, I don't care what you think of him as, whether it's Meher Baba, whether you're a Catholic, a Protestant, atheist, but if you turn to a higher thing or a higher being, and you really ask for something, you are going to get it. Now you say, well, that's not true. But you get it in a different way than you think, but you get an answer. It's happened. It always has happened to me, even if I haven't recognized it. Well, I went home and I didn't know how to pray, really. So I said to God, well, I don't believe in you, but if the studio offers me the terms I want, then I'll accept the job and I'll believe in you. But this was a terrible thing for me. I mean, to think that I'm praying and somebody might have caught me at it, you know. Something you just don't like, that people just know this about you. This is the weirdies. Well, I prayed and I put a time limit on it. I said, by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. And 9 o'clock the next morning the telephone rang. It was the studio and they accepted the terms. I must drop dead. And I made a deal, but I said, oh, that's a coincidence. I didn't believe it at all. You know, I believed the terms, of course, and I accepted the job, and I didn't believe in God. You know, how can you believe in God just for that, you know? There's no proof. I'm from Missouri. I've always been from Missouri. I still am, unfortunately. I'm like that. If you told me that there was a miracle happening in the next room, I wouldn't believe you, really. I'd say, yeah, well, maybe, but I'd have to see it with my own eyes. I just can't accept things because someone tells me. That's why I couldn't accept God and all these other things. So anyway, I accepted the job. And I worked there for, I guess a couple of years. And one day I saw a book on the desk, and I think now it was left there deliberately. It must have been, because these people never talked to me about God or religion or anything. They knew better. But the title of the book was The Edinburgh Lectures by Judge The Edinburgh Lectures on Mental Science by Judge Trowood. Has anyone ever read it? Well, it was the beginning. It's a new thought idea. When I opened that book and read it, the world was one way. But when I closed it, it changed. The world was different. The gist of the book was that everything is run by the mind. Whatever you can train your mind to do, you can have. You can be healthy, wealthy, and wise. In other words, you can create with the mind. Well, you know, there's some truth in that. There is a certain amount of truth, but that's not everybody. That doesn't mean any man in the street can think something is going to happen. You can do a lot with your mind, but you're not going to have cancer and become healthy just because you're thinking you're healthy. There are a lot of things you're not going to do because of karma. But nevertheless, I thought, wow, this is something, you know. So I'm like this. Once I get onto something, I go full steam ahead. I think I read everything. I don't think there's anything I haven't read on this subject. I ended up taking the 2-year science, 2-year college course, it was called, on mental science, given by, what was his name again? Charles Raymond Barker. You've probably heard of him. At the end of the course, I graduated and got a certificate that said you can now hang out a shingle and charge for healing people. I have that certificate yet. I never used it because I didn't believe it, tell the truth. I really didn't believe it. But nevertheless, I still thought there was something there, you know. You can do certain things with the mind because I tried it out. You can do certain things, but it's not colossal things. So, time went on, and one day, of course, I got involved with this, and of course, I even got involved with the two people that were running the studio, and we were all religious scientists and that sort of thing. We went to Camp Barbas Out, which is the Council of Churches. They had a camp out there, and up there, I met a girl by the name of Louise. her whole, Louise James, her name was. And I happened to be sitting on the beach by Lake Winnipesaukee, it was right at Camp Odstout, and I looked at her. We hadn't met, really. I just saw her, and she looked at me, and we were completely drawn to each other. There was something that was like a magnet. I don't know what it was. I never felt anything so strong until later, of course. And she had said she felt the same thing. And we began talking about religious science. We became very interested. We decided to meet in the city. When we got back to New York, we did meet, and she had come to the same conclusion I did. That, I know, I have a feeling in my back or something. Mm-hmm. She had come to the same conclusion I did, that this religious science, or mental science, whatever you want to call it, was all right, and we believed in it, but you know, we really weren't doing with it what they said you could do with it. There was something lacking, and we felt it was lack of power. And that the way we could get power, the theory was all right, you know, it was to get a whole lot of people that believed the same thing together and generate more power in a group to be able to do the things we wanted mentally. So she said to me, well, we can get a lot of people to my house. I know a Mr. Frederick, another key person. This was Phyllis's father, turned out. Phyllis Frederick. Many of you know Phyllis. And she said, he's a very interesting man. He's a gourmet. He's been the editor of a magazine. He's an intellectual. He knows so many things. And he knows just loads of people. Now, with all the people that he knows, we're bound to meet some or a few that really can, we can do something with. So I said, well, fine. Great. So she said, we'll meet at my house. So we got Andy, the fellow with the studio, to go also. And we met at Louise's house every other week for 2 or 3 hours, and Mr. Frederick would hold forth and talk, very intelligent man. And it was interesting. And then later on he'd cook some gourmet dish, and we'd all eat and drink, and we had a marvelous time. Mm-hmm. And this went on. Oh, for I don't know how many months it's gone on. And then one night, Mr. Frederick said, you know, you can't always be listening to me. I maybe should listen to somebody else once in a while. So, who could we listen to? Who would be interesting enough? So he said, how about my daughter? He said, the reason I suggest my daughter is because she met this Eastern master, and she likes to talk about him. And you know, if you knew my daughter before and saw her now, he really helped her a lot. She's changed. But I don't believe in him, he said, but, you know, he's helped my daughter, so you might find it interesting. It'll be another evening, you know, another interesting evening. So, you know, all this intellectual business. So he invited Phyllis to come. And this time, for some reason or other, we didn't meet at Louise's apartment. It was quite a big crowd, and we met in another apartment. Don't ask me where it was. Somewhere on the east side, there was a big grand piano, and there was a huge program, and it was crowded. And somebody got up, and they read their poems. Someone else got up and sang. Someone else played the piano, and it was really quite a long evening. Then Phyllis got up, and there was a cushion placed in the middle of the floor, and Phyllis sat on the cushion. And she just talked very quietly. You know, Phyllis, how quiet she is. She just sits and very simply spoke about Baba. And I listened. I thought that she had a question and answer period. And of course, I had so many questions. I always did. You know, I had gotten so interested previous to this, going from church to church, investigating the Catholic, going back to the Protestant religion, all the religions, and finding out, trying to find, what is this that people are interested in? There must be something here, but you know, what is it? And I found that they all had a little something, but none of them really had enough for me. So that's why I said, forget it. I forgot all about it. And that's when I went to the Bolin studio. Well, so here we were. We had this question and answer period, and people were asking the darndest questions, and me too, and some of them got furious with Phyllis. Because of the answers. They didn't like her answers, but, you know, because some of the answers really put the blame on them. karma, you know, and they don't like that. People don't like to take their own blame for their own lives. They like to blame circumstances or life or their parents or you or me or anything, but not themselves. You see, I'm not responsible for my unhappiness. This is their attitude. And the interesting thing was that even though they were furious and very rude to Phyllis, she never got the least bit angry back. Her attitude, her answers were as calm and as sweet as if, you know, everybody had been nice to her. And this impressed me too. And then she gave answers on why animals suffer, about war, why races suffer, why certain religions suffer, why this, why that. Oh, so many things, you know, things that I never had an answer to before. I was told I just had to believe, which I just can't just believe because someone says I must believe. I just can't do that. And this girl was practicing what other people were talking about and not practicing, you see. So I was impressed. And she said at the end of the session, if you're interested in meetings, just leave your name and address at the end of the session, and I will send you notice when we have meetings. This was the Monday night group, which at that time was held at Fred and Ella's apartment on East 66th Street, I think it was, 65th Street. That was a Manhattan house. Well, that night finished, and a couple of weeks later, I received a postal card saying that there was a Monday night meeting at Fred and Ella's. So I called Louise, and I said, Louise, I got a notice about these Meher Baba meetings. Would you like to go? She said, well, I got one too. She said, it's just another group. Forget it. Something for me. Maybe she's right. So I forgot it. And a couple of weeks later, another notice came. And Phyllis was saying, told me much later, that they said, we should clear this list out and get rid of some of these names. They're not answering. Nobody, you know, let's get rid of them. And she said, no, I believe in holding on. I believe in holding on. And it's lucky she did, because I don't know how many notices I got, and always Louise threw cold water on it. So finally, one day, I got this notice. I called Louise again, and she said the same thing. Well, I said, oh, I'm going. She said, all right, I'll go with you. No. So, but I always had this pull every time. I have to tell you this feeling I had, this inner pull every time I received this card. It was strange. Just the same type of pull I had with Louise. You see, Louise was a key person. Well, at the same time, right after this, the studio collapsed. Bing, out of business, gone. That was one scaffolding gone. My marriage was broken up. That was the end of that. My mother became ill. She died within 3 years. My father had a cerebral hemorrhage, and he was never in his right mind completely for 12 years. He died 12 years after that. I myself became ill. I was told I needed an operation. I really thought I was on my last leg. I wasn't. I didn't need the operation, but I thought so. So, you know, if you think it, you're in just as much gloom as if it were true. Well, this was the state I was in just before I met Baba. Now, just about a year before this, I'm through an old boyfriend of mine. Of course, I was always very much involved in one boyfriend after another, one after another. I'd get out of one, there'd be another one, I'd get out of one, there'd be another one. And finally, about a year before got involved with this, hearing about the Baba group, I met, through an old boyfriend of mine, Pierre, I met a young couple. And about a year after that, this young couple broke up, but I didn't know about all that. You know, I just met them once or twice. But I was the key person for the man in that duet. His name was Philip. Last time I tried to keep initials, but I'm not going to try this time. You'll never know him anyway, so his name was Philip. And this was to be another entanglement in my life. I mean, it was going on and on right until the time I met Baba. Well, now, where was I? I had just gotten to a point where, let me see, I don't want to start getting into something that's it's going to take a long time. I want to get through with this tonight. I've already left a whole bunch out, but I have to, I really have to make sure I don't get too involved. Yes. We went. We went to the group, and at the time that I went to the group, they were reading the discourses. Now, the discourses they were reading there were, I don't know how many other people had the discourses, but they were not available at that time. You just couldn't buy books like you can today. And a lot of the books that are out, like God Speaks and Listen Humanity, weren't even in embryo stage. They weren't even thought of at the time, except by Baba. And I remember it was Michael Kohana one night that was reading the discourse on sex to the group. And Philip wasn't there at the time, but I was. And I thought, like that. I didn't, the other stuff sounds interesting, you know, but I just couldn't accept that. I still wasn't sure. Baba hadn't manifested at this time. You know, he didn't say he was the highest of the high. That hadn't come out yet. And I was told, though, that Baba was a perfect master. And I had just been hearing from various sources that there were such things as yogis that came from the Far East, and that yogis had powers because they devoted more time. They knew more than we did in the West. This much I knew. And, you know, I thought, well, they have the secret. So, you know, this was another reason I was attracted to Baba. I thought, well, perfect master. Well, what's perfect master? You know, a master is a master. A master of painting, you know, a master of music. But perfect master, well, I just thought that was the term. I really did, you know, perfect master doesn't explain anything really by itself. So I really wasn't sure what a perfect master was. So, but I did think, well, I'd like to know more. Maybe this is the one that can teach me how to become healthy, wealthy, and wise. Because by this time I felt I needed healing. My marriage was gone. You know, I was no job. I mean, my mother and father were kaput, my family. I was in the spot that Catholic girl had told me, you know, the teacher at Maya Boleyn's had told me. You know, I was right down at the bottom. That's where I finally landed. So that Baba does that. He pulls the rug from under you just before he's ready to take over. And there was just nothing left in my life. Well, Philip was coming into it, which I didn't know at the time, because he had called me on my last day home. I don't know how it happened. I had left home, I'd come into New York, and I went back to the house which the family was selling, and I was in my room just taking a few things that I wanted to take with me into New York, and the phone rang, and it was Philip. Would I have lunch with him? He wanted to discuss religious science, which I found he did, but he also was interested in other things. And we had lunch together, and we discussed religious science, and it was through me, as I said, that he got interested in Baba, in the Baba group. So Philip and I, let me see now, I don't want to get involved. Well, my mother died in April of 1952, and you know, I never cried. I had never cried in my life. This was an interesting thing, and it's interesting in you see what happens next. Of course, my father was ill too. He went to live with my sisters. Then we heard from the group. Of course, Philip had heard about Baba's discourse on sex, and oh, I won't go into this now. But he used to walk up and down the floor, and the things he used to say. Well, that was terrible. It was insane. Still, he had these powers. Let's find out about them. So we went, to the meetings. I think Philip went to one only. He went to very few, and I didn't go to too many in the beginning. It was just touch and go. But we did hear, Louise and I heard that Baba was coming to New York in 1952. But no, he was going to, then we heard, no, he's going to Myrtle Beach. So we thought, oh, we'll go to Myrtle Beach and we'll meet him. We were going to drive. But Andy couldn't go on account of business. Louise couldn't drive, and I couldn't drive, and Philip couldn't go, so that finished that. I said, that's all right, I have a feeling he's coming to New York. Don't tell me how I had that feeling, but I had a feeling he was coming to New York. And it was in 52, and, you know, he did come to New York. So by this time, I was cooling off about meeting him. I was getting much too involved again with in Maya, and, you know, oh, I was on a pink cloud, and, you know, I was very much in love, and, you know. So I called Philip, and I said, you know, I think that Bob is coming to New York on such and such a day, with July 20th, and the Meher Baba group will meet him. I think it was at 3 or 4 o'clock, I'm not sure, 2 in the afternoon, at Ivy Deuce's apartment. I said, are you interested in going? You know, I was cooling by then, and he said, oh yeah, let's go. So I said, all right. So I called Ivy Deuce, and unfortunately, though, Philip had to go, had to take a plane to I think it was Mexico, or Texas. He had business in Texas. That very afternoon, he couldn't make it with the Meher Baba group. So he said, can we make it earlier so I can make my plane? So I called Ivy, and she said, yes, I'll put you in ahead of the others. So it was easy. So it was a sweltering hot day. It was over 100, really was. I remember I had on a red check dress that Philip had bought me. I had no sleeves, but I had long black gloves. Why on a hot day like that, I'll never know. But this is interesting too, why the long black gloves. We were ushered in to the Baba's room. And I just walked across the threshold. I went first, and Philip came after me. And as I stepped on the threshold, and I looked at Baba, he was there, long white sandal, lying on the couch. Now, they say he had his leg in a cast. But, you know, I don't remember that. I don't remember anything about his leg being in a cast. I didn't see it. They said there were mandali in the room. I didn't see them. I didn't see anybody. There must have been somebody, because Baba wasn't speaking, you see, and he was using his alphabet board at the time. But when I stepped on the threshold and I looked at him, I had a shock. It was physical, like an electric shock if you step with bare feet on a live wire. It went from my feet right up to the top of my head. And then it seemed, I can't explain about time. I suppose you've seen movies where people are going in slow motion, and it seems to take them for hours get where they're going. Well, that's how it seemed to me. I was normal, but yet it was a long time. It was fast and it was slow. It's slow and fast at the same time. I just really can't explain how it was, because this was totally unexpected. We were told we couldn't speak to Baba. We couldn't ask him questions, that he was just like the crown jewels that we'd go by and look at in the case. That was it. So I didn't expect anything, you know. Here I walk and I get this tremendous shock. And I look at him, and then this feeling, again, a physical feeling of love. It was love. Don't ask me how I knew it was love. It was love. It was like a great big wave, and it just came right over, almost knocked me backwards. And yet I had to advance forward. And we got to him after centuries, and he put out his hand, and here I had this glove. Well, I didn't know I was going to shake hands with him. Well, I was so embarrassed to have to shake hands with a glove. But I had to shake hands. I did. So then Baba motioned to a low stool next to him. First, I sat here. Baba was here. And Philip sat next to me. I didn't even look at Philip. I looked at Baba, and he spelled that on his blackboard. I know them, but they don't know me. Which was true. And then he looked at Philip and he said, he looks like an uncle of mine. You know, very friendly. So Philip was very pleased. Yeah. And then I saw in my mind's eye a huge phallus. Don't ask me where it came from, you know? Oh, God, you know? What did I say? Why, you know? And then the next thing, right after that, I had this tremendous jealousy of Philip. Here was Baba paying attention to him. Here was Baba saying, "You look like an uncle of mine." Does he want Philip or does he want me? Yeah. So, you know, this made me more confused because, you know, what was Baba to me? I don't know Baba. It was Philip I was in love with. It was Philip I could have killed. If I had a knife, I'd have stuck it right into him. You know, I don't know what was happening to me. I was, what's going on here, you know? And it was more and more confused. In the confusion, I was trying to get my glove off because I kind of felt, well, he's going to shake hands, so we, you know, we leave. I'm worrying about little, you know, details of life, being polite and, you know, all this stuff. Well, anyway, Baba said something else. He said something about their work for me will do this or that. I don't remember. By then, I couldn't hear anymore. I didn't know what was going on. I wish I could remember what it was I was going to do.
Billy, what was that thing with the dog?
Oh, that. That was one of the things I was leaving.
Tell us.
Oh, all right. She wants to tell me about, she wants me to tell you, rather, about the dog. Excuse me, I do better standing up. I can't stand sitting. But, the dog incident. Well, when I saw Baba and this feeling of love, the next thing Baba did was turn his head to one side, and his look was ecstatic. It was like a dog of mine. He reminded me of my dog that had died several years before. When I used to go away for a long time and I'd come back to the house, she would get very excited. So excited to see me, she couldn't run to me. She'd stiffen her legs. She'd get all ecstatic, and she'd turn her head to one side, squint her eyes, and wag her tail, and she'd just stand there, shaking all over. Well, Baba had that same look. He did. You know, it seemed terribly irreverent, but he must have done it deliberately, knowing how devoted I was to my dog, you know, how I love that dog, and know that. And see, he probably wanted me to recognize the love, you know, because the love that I felt that day was stronger than any love I'd felt from any human being, and all the human beings put together I'd ever known. There is nothing to compare with it, nothing. It was the most fantastic thing I'd ever experienced. Well, now, let's not get too involved. Let's see where I am now. Where do I stop? Oh yes, we left. Then Philip had to take the plane. He got down to the street and it was hot. I'll never forget how hot it was. Well, all of a sudden I began to shiver and I got goosebumps all over me and I was shaking, my teeth were chattering, and what on earth's the matter with me? And Philip said, "What happened to you?" We said, "What's the matter?" I said, "I'm cold. I'm freezing." He said, "How can you freeze on a day like today?" Well, I said, "I am freezing." And he said, "All right, tight." He says, then all of a sudden, he says, I said, "What's the matter?" "Something wrong with my stomach." "I've got butterflies." He said, "I think I'm going to pass out." I said, "Well, what's the matter with, what are you blaming me for?" I said, "It must be the heat." He said, "I think we need a drink." So he called a cab, we got into the cab, we went to the Hotel Commodore, and we ordered drinks. You see how unprepared we were. I mean, all we can think of, and there was baseball, we were looking at baseball on TV. We had no idea what all this was about. We were doing the things that we knew best. You know, we drank and had watched baseball game, but then all of a sudden, as we were watching, I began to cry. This was the first time I'd ever cried. Why was I crying? I had no reason to cry. What was I crying for? And I was crying and crying, and people began to look at me. I was sobbing, big sobs. And he got embarrassed too, so he snatched me out of there. We took a cab to the airport, and I saw him off on the plane. Well, he saw a vision of Baba through the window of the plane, sitting on a cloud. And he said, he closed his eyes. He told me this when he came back, of course. I didn't know at the time. He closed his eyes, and he looked again, and he's still there. He says, I'm going out of, he said he's going out of his mind, you know, because we weren't used to this type of thing. The sort of thing you go in for every day. Well, now, I don't want to get involved with too much, since, you know, I want to finish this tonight. What time?
You need a lot of time.
Well, I'm not getting anywhere. Oh, yes, there was some interesting thing, but when I was with Baba, you know, I had gone to him not only to learn all these things, but I felt that he could heal me somehow. So I looked, and I felt that his eyes draw mine, and he looked into my eyes. And you know, I knew that he wasn't going to heal me. I knew he wasn't for that. I don't know how I knew that, but I knew it wasn't to be. Of course, I didn't need healing anyway, but I, you know, if I had, it would have been the same thing. It was very interesting. I don't know how I knew that. Well, let me see. Here we are. The Wees met Baba the day before I did. I wasn't there, of course, but I did find out from Phyllis that she had asked Baba, how can I help people? And he had replied to Louise, those who know they do not need to do anything. Of course, that went over Louise's head completely. I don't think, she didn't take to Baba. I saw Louise once or twice after that, and then she disappeared from my life. She was a key person. She disappeared completely. I called her apartment, she had gone. There was no way I could trace her. I had never seen or heard from her till this day. And that was in 1952. You see, something else had gone out of my life. It's just like as if Baba had pulled the rug from under me, and then each thing I was involved in, he broke it down, so there was no way back. There was only a way forward. I could never go back. My family were scattered. Everything was gone. The jobs, everything. It was just no place I could go but forward. I tell you, for about 3 months after I met Baba, I cried every day. For no reason. I'd be walking in the street and all of a sudden, be crying. And it wasn't sorrow. It was plain ice-cold tears. They just keep streaming down my face. And I didn't know what it was all about. I was completely confused. I found out later, though, that people do this quite often when they meet Baba. So, then I went, Philip didn't go to the Baba meetings very much, but I began to go, not too regularly, but more regularly than before. And in about 6 months, it took us 6 months, really, before we began to realize who Baba was. Of course, he was a perfect master, but as I said before, perfect masters, you know, what does it mean, really? It doesn't explain itself. And one night, just before the meeting, Philip and I went to dinner, and I had begun to have feelings about this. And I said to Philip, you know, Philip, I'm beginning to have funny feelings about Father. I said, do you know who he is? He said, I was wondering if you were ever going to get wise to that. He said, are you thinking what I'm thinking? I said, yes, I think I am. I said, he says, well, what do you think? I said, I think he was Jesus. I think he'd come back. I think, you know, that I hadn't gotten as far as Buddha and Muhammad and all that, but he had been Jesus. You see, I hadn't realized that he might have been all these other people too at one time. But Jesus. So I said, well, I'm scared. And he said, I'm scared too. And you, if you knew him, his eyebrows shot up and the first startled. You know, he said, I don't like this either. I said, you know, the followers of Jesus were thrown to the lions. And I don't want to face a lion. I don't think I can do it. I'm not a heroine. I'm not that type, you know. I said, what are we going to do? He said, well, what can we do? I said, we can't go back. He says, no, we can't. We can't not know what we know. You know it, so you just don't suddenly become stupid and not know anymore. You just know. There's no turning back. We can only go on with it. By then, we had begun to love Baba, and we'd only seen him for a few minutes, you see. So there we were. We decided, well, keep our fingers crossed and go on.